I started murdering people, there'd be none of you left.
Disclaimer. The following broadcast gives a true and honest account of the events described, and all evidence and details herein are solely factual. What you are about to hear is real and may disturb you. Caution is strongly advised. Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
If you enjoy our show and find our research interesting, please leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does go a long way in helping us out. You can find out more about us and our work at www.deadsoulspodcast.com or over on Instagram by searching our name. As always, thank you for joining us. On September 26, 2023, Netflix will drop a 3-part true crime documentary series about the murder of Jill Dando. I'm pretty confident that it will skim the surface of this mystery, so I wanted to present my own research into the events that surround the infamous and unsolved crime. In addition, I would also like to discuss a theory that I think Netflix might overlook, or be told to overlook. Let's begin. Jill Dando was known to her family and many devoted fans of her journalistic, written and television presenting work for having a reputation as a strong, reliable reporter and motivated and intelligent investigator. She was insightful, determined and held in high esteem inside the world of media. She was admired among her peers and respected for her professionalism and tenacity. Her deep-rooted connection with criminal examinations and broadcast media, as well as her inclination to take dives into sensitive material and disputable cases, made her a prominent figure on television throughout the 1990s in the United Kingdom. But her life was sadly cut short by her still unexplained assassination on the morning of April 26, 1999. It left all who knew her grasping for answers in a sea of evidence that led to dead ends, doubts, conspiracies, and ultimately posed more questions than it answered. The country mourned the loss of Jill. She was loved by the nation. It was a time before the internet had truly taken hold, so media was limited and of far less volume than it is today. This meant Jill received millions upon millions of viewers regularly who tuned into her TV shows and news broadcasts. The impact on the general public was significant. Tonight we examine the murder of Jill Dando and analyse the wave of controversies that surround this case.
A massive police hunt is underway tonight in West London for the killer of Jill Dando, who was murdered earlier today outside her terraced home in Fulham.
Within the last hour, it's been announced that the television presenter Jill Dando has died after being attacked outside her London home. Police say she was found in the street this lunchtime with serious head injuries and was taken to the Charing Cross Hospital.
And the television presenter Jill Dando has died after she was attacked outside her West London home. Miss Dando, who was 37, was found by a friend in the street. She had serious head injuries and was taken to hospital.
Jill Dando, known and loved by millions, has been brutally murdered. The 37-year-old presenter died in hospital after being found shot through the head on her own doorstep. Tonight in West London, a massive police hunt for the well-dressed man seen running away down the street in which she lived.
Good evening. The TV personality Jill Dando, who as Crime Watch presenter helped to send dozens of criminals to jail, was murdered on her own doorstep today. Tonight, the mystery over her death deepened with speculation that the killing may have been revenge for her anti-crime work. She was attacked at her home in Fulham in West London. A man was seen hurrying away.
The murder of Jill Dando is a very British crime. British in the sense that those who live outside the Four Nations are not likely to know the name Jill Dando. So let's talk about who she was and share with our overseas listeners her background and character. Jill Wendy Dando was born on the 9th of November 1961 in the small seaside town of Weston-super-Mare, known simply as Weston to locals. The town sits in the county of Somerset, just on the Bristol Channel. It's not a very big place. It has around 82,000 permanent inhabitants and still retains much of the classical Gothic, Moorish and Flemish mix of architecture designed by the town's architect Hans Price in the mid-1800s. Jill was born at the Ashcombe House Maternity Home in Weston to parents Winifred Mary Jean Hockey and Jack Dando. She had one sibling, a brother Nigel, who was 9 years her senior. Jill was raised as a Christian, a Baptist to be accurate, and remained a devout follower for her entire life. When she was a toddler, Jill was diagnosed with having a hole in her heart and a blocked pulmonary artery. She underwent heart surgery on the 12th of January 1965, when she had only just turned 3 years old. Jill made a complete recovery. Jill always held a deeply rooted fascination for television, an interest that she shared with her older brother. She knew from a young age that her career would be in that field, although she wasn't sure specifically what. Jill attended World Comprehensive School, followed by Broad Oak Sixth Form Centre, where she was head girl. A head girl, for those outside of the UK, is a sort of valedictorian, someone who is top of their graduating class. In the UK, however, we don't hold a graduation ceremony, so there is no expectation for a head girl to deliver a graduation speech. By all accounts, she was focused, intelligent, and all round a great student. She was seen by her classmates and school friends as a kind, girl next door type. She had goals and was very motivated in achieving them. She was also very well liked amongst her peers. She was polite, sensitive, and always had the time and energy to give to others. It was at World Comprehensive, her high school, where she developed an affection for broadcast media. She developed a DJ and radio personality. An interesting fact, which we will talk about more a bit later, was that early in her media training, she was spotted by television personality Jimmy Savile, who praised Jill's natural talents and pushed for Jill to have the opportunity to get into television broadcasting. In 1979, following Jill's graduation from Broad Oak Sixth Form, she enrolled in the South Glamorgan Institute of Higher Education in Cardiff, now known as Cardiff Metropolitan University. She studied journalism, but she also took part in performing arts while there and took part in a number of theatre companies, which she felt would improve and refine her public speaking abilities and techniques. Jill wasted no time in immersing herself into the world of journalism. Even in her first year of university, she supported her academic journey by volunteering at the Sunshine Hospital Radio in her hometown of Weston. Jill graduated Cardiff Met University with a first in journalism. Head of year, in fact. She wasted no time in securing her first media position as a trainee reporter, a position that she secured with the Weston Mercury newspaper. She got the job through connections of her father and brother, who were fellow employees of the newspaper at the time. She remained in that position for a while before progressing to the role of full-time reporter around 5 years later, but she wanted more than just to work in print journalism. So in 1985, she began work at the British Broadcasting Corporation, or the BBC, becoming a newsreader for BBC Radio Devon, a regional position in the south of England. She got the position after being scouted by the head of the radio station, John Lilly. Jill grew both as a professional journalist, but also as a storyteller. She quickly found her niche as a newsreader at the station for the early morning programming. This work also garnered Jill another position at the BBC. She took on BBC Southwest Television news magazine Spotlight as main presenter. During her early years at the BBC, Jill was met with a personal crisis when in 1986, when she was just 24 years old, her mother died after an 18-month battle with leukemia. In 1988, Jill's gravitas and endearing persona led her to national television work in London's Television Centre. Bob Wheaton, then editor of Breakfast Time, had recruited Jill initially as an occasional stand-in presenter on the BBC One morning news magazine. But as her presenting shifts became more regular, she would develop a long and occasionally stormy relationship with Wheaton that was to last for most of the 1990s. The top brass at the BBC recognised Jill's potential for more high-profile television shows. So in 1993, she was part of the updated and rejuvenated Holiday programme, a long-standing show for the BBC that was given a new lease of life and breath of fresh air with Dando at the helm. Jill brought a mix of journalistic integrity and genuine charm to the travel diary-style television show. She thrived under pressure and worked well with tight deadlines. The more punishing the filming schedule, the better for her performance, she felt. She logged over 80,000 miles in just a single year. This was combined with regular stints as BBC One newscaster and her new role as Crime Watch co-presenter. Crime Watch was a show featuring reconstructions of the UK's most recent serious crimes and a current top wanted felons rundown. Crime Watch ran for over 25 years, and in that time it helped catch 57 murderers, 53 rapists and sex offenders, 18 pedophiles and multiple other criminals across the country. Jill moved to Fulham in London in early 1994 as her work for national television came in thick and fast. She purchased a house at 29 Gowan Avenue. It was pre-internet, so this information was not widely available and would have been known to family, friends and her employers only. Something which will hold further meaning later on in this episode. From mid-1995, Jill co-presented Crime Watch with Nick Ross, a man who had significant admiration for Jill, both as a professional and as a person. "You'll only ever hear kind things about Jill, because there were only ever kind things to say about her," Ross said in a 1999 interview. At the peak of Jill's popularity, she would win the BBC Personality of the Year Award in 1997, as well as claiming the title of highest profile amongst BBC on-air personalities. She was the golden girl of British television, and was asked to present the upcoming Millennium New Year coverage on BBC One, a coveted slot by presenters and television personalities at the time. Throughout her career, Jill was graceful and compassionate. Her personality was infectious, and everyone across Great Britain knew who she was. Even Jill's personal life was a point of focus amongst her fans and in the British tabloid press, with her receiving rare praise and respect from the public due to her dedication to her Baptist lifestyle and navigation of difficult personal tragedies. She was even compared to Princess Diana, being called the Diana of the media. There was even a similar physical resemblance between the two. Many fans and well-wishers were eager to see Jill happily marry the well-known Dr. Alan Farthing. Farthing was a hugely respected obstetrician and consultant gynaecologist at St. Mary's Hospital in Westminster, London. Dr. Farthing was also an honorary senior lecturer at Imperial College London and a specialist in gynaecological cancer care. He was also an internationally recognized expert in the use of laparoscopic and hysterectoscopic surgery. Farthing and Dando were the perfect match and had been engaged since January the 31st, 1999. They were set to be married in September of 1999. Jill Dando was the quintessential British national treasure, a beloved icon the country over. Simon Calder, reporter for the Independent newspaper, said the following about Jill Dando in an April 1999 article. Quote, "Only very rarely does a broadcaster become so much a part of our lives that the mere mention of their name is enough to conjure up an instant and wholly positive image." So bringing us up to 1999 now then, Jill was featured on the cover of Radio Times magazine for the week commencing the 24th to the 30th of April. The Radio Times was the UK version of what in the United States was known as the TV Guide, a magazine that was hugely popular with a massive readership. It featured celebrity news, gossip, features and articles from the world of showbiz, as well as listing the television schedules for each day of the week. Less than 2 weeks later, Jill was booked to host the British Academy Television Awards, alongside popular UK celebrity television presenter Michael Parkinson, at Grosvenor House on the 9th of May. The awards are the UK equivalent to the Emmys, and during the 1990s would regularly attract around 20 million viewers. At this point in her career, Jill was among those with the highest profile in UK television's on-screen personalities. But sadly, all that Jill Dando had to give and all that she had achieved came to a sudden end. Fate had other plans for Jill. On April the 26th, 1999, the country expected to tune into the 6 o'clock news, expecting to see Jill delivering the evening news programme. Instead, BBC viewers were met prematurely with a breaking news bulletin, but it wasn't being delivered by the person that they would expect. It was delivered about the person they would least expect. So what do we know about what happened that day? On the morning of April 26th, 1999, at around 10 a.m, Jill leaves her partner Alan Farthing's home in the West London district of Chiswick. She is alone and heads back to her home by car in a BMW 320i convertible. En route, and a little after 10:25 a.m, Jill pulls into a garage or gas station to fill up her car before heading back onto the A4 dual lane carriageway, heading in the direction of Hammersmith. At 10:36 a.m, Jill parks up at the King's Mall. Jill visits three stores while in the mall. Reitman's, where she purchased printer paper at 10:49 a.m. Then the second store she goes into is a Dixon's electronics retailer, but she leaves without making a purchase here. Finally, she makes a final stop at The Link, a cell phone and internet communication store, which is approximately 11:01 a.m. At the time, The Link was owned by parent company Dixon's Retail, so it's fair to assume that whatever she was looking for to purchase in Dixon's, they didn't have in stock, so referred her to their partner store, The Link, and given their specific and limited range, it's likely a cell phone or related item. Jill finally exits the shopping mall at 11:04 a.m. Eyewitnesses see Jill driving west along King Street. She does, after all, have one of the most recognisable faces in the country at the time, before making a hard 180-degree turn, going underneath the Hammersmith flyover and towards Fulham Palace Road. CCTV captures Jill at 11:10 a.m. as she turns onto Manborough Road, a quick shortcut in Jill's journey home. Between 11:20 and 11:25 a.m, Jill stops briefly at Cape Seafood, a fishmonger, where she purchases two fillets of Dover sole, a fish exclusive to the North Atlantic and Mediterranean, which is particularly popular in the United Kingdom. Jill received a phone call at 11:23 a.m. while she is still being served the seafood. The call is not suspicious and has been traced and verified by police. At around 11:29 a.m, Jill arrives back at her seldomly used home at Gowan Avenue in Fulham. The house is currently up for sale and hardly ever visited by Jill herself. She spends almost all of her time at the home of her fiancé, Dr. Farthing. At 11:31 a.m, Jill exits her vehicle and walks through a very small front garden and to her front door. At the front door, she reaches out to grab the door handle, but before she can twist the handle, Jill is approached from behind. An assailant grabs her with his right arm and forces her to the ground so that her face was almost touching the tiled step of the porch. Then with his left hand, he fires a single gunshot into her left temple, killing her instantly, execution style. The bullet entered her head just above her ear, parallel to the ground, and came out of the right side of her head, leaving a small, neat hole. At around the same time, Richard Hughes, who was living next door, stated that he heard a yell from Jill. "It sounded like someone greeting a friend," he said. Hughes doesn't hear any gunshots, nor does he witness any murder. He does, however, catch a glimpse of a man leaving the scene, and Hughes is the only witness to actually see Jill's killer. Hughes described the man as 6-foot-tall white male in his 40s, with short dark hair. Jill's body isn't found until 15 minutes later at 11:46 a.m. Helen Doble, another Fulham suburb neighbour, sees Jill laying motionless as she passed by and calls an ambulance.
I'm walking along Gowan Avenue. It looks like there's somebody collapsed. Coincidentally, it looks like it's Jill Dando, and she's collapsed in her door. There's a lot of blood.
You just approach and check that the lady's breathing.
She doesn't look as if she's breathing. She's got blood coming from her nose. Her arms are blue.
I just need to find out if she needs, if she's breathing. Is the lady's chest going up and down?
Oh my God, no, I don't think she's alive.
Right, okay. Don't worry, I'm going to get some help there as fast as I can.
Shortly after, paramedics and authorities arrive at the scene and they transport Jill to Charing Cross Hospital without hesitation. Despite this rapid response, Jill Dando is pronounced dead on arrival at 1:03 p.m. Closed circuit cameras, or CCTV, recorded a blue Range Rover speeding out of Donerall Street opposite Gowan Avenue at 11:50. The car turned into Fulham Palace Road so fast that it leaned over, witnesses said, before roaring through a red light on Putney Bridge. The number plate of the blue Range Rover could not be made out on the CCTV footage, but a witness confirmed that it was driven by a dark-haired man. Dr. Farthing, Jill's fiancé, reported to police that as he left for work that Monday morning, some 4 hours before Jill's murder, he had seen a man with dark hair sat in a dark blue Range Rover parked near his London house. Dr. Farthing was convinced either saw the killer or a killer's accomplice. The Metropolitan Police told Farthing that they believe the dark-haired motorist in the Range Rover was acting as a lookout for the gunman who was lurking outside Jill's nearby home. The man in the Range Rover was thought to have been stalking Jill during the 9 days she spent at Dr. Farthing's luxury house in Chiswick prior to her death. The police initially told Farthing that the man in the Range Rover likely tipped off his accomplice via mobile phone when she finally left Farthing's home, while the accomplice waited at Jill's address on Gowan Avenue for her to arrive. Police believe the driver either picked up or was supposed to pick up the fleeing gunman following the shooting. Additionally, a postman revealed that when he delivered mail to Jill's house just an hour before she was killed, he noticed a dark-haired man in a suit staring at him from across the street, seemingly watching the house. Conspiracy theories instantly emerged about who was behind the strange and seemingly pointless murder. The timing, the style of the murder, and the skill of the killer, combined with Jill's public profile, led to a huge and a far-reaching investigation by Scotland Yard detectives. Thousands of leads were generated, and many theories and roads into the investigation were thoroughly travelled. To this day, the killer has never been brought to justice. Jill Dando's murder quickly became the biggest criminal investigation of the 1990s in the UK. Scotland Yard's homicide squad would go on to interview more than 2,500 people. They took more than 1,000 official statements and received almost 10,000 lines of communication and tracked and traced more than 1,200 cars, all at a price of almost £5 million in today's inflated costing. But who killed Jill Dando and why? Scotland Yard investigated tip-offs, leaks and theories related to the Mafia, Russian and Eastern European gangsters, ex-lovers and scorned suitors, London criminal networks and of course the Serbian government. But one thing seemed glaringly obvious to the police at the time, and that the murder appeared more and more like the work of a professional assassin. Jill's brother Nigel publicly stated to the Times newspaper in November 1999 that his personal feeling is that it was probably someone looking for a kick or for notoriety. Because Jill presented the hugely popular and widely circulated Crime Watch programme for the BBC, many people believed that she had been hunted down by somebody who was related to something she had spoken about or revealed on the show. Potentially a crime that she had reported on, or a criminal group that she had exposed. Others commented that obsessed fans or a stalker could be to blame. These weren't random claims or theories. All of the ideas put forward had evidence to support the claims. Jill did receive death threats for her work on Crime Watch. She had received obsessed fan letters, and stalkers were spoken about in her recent past. Additionally, her work reported on the Serbian Kosovo War led some to look in that direction. Was the murder a case of mistaken identity, perhaps? In June 2022, French court papers would accuse Gerald Marie, the director of French elite modeling agency, of using the Russian mafia to try and kill Lisa Brinksworth, a former BBC journalist who exposed him as a sex abuser in the late 1990s. The gunman may have assassinated television presenter Jill Dando in a case of mistaken identity. According to allegations presented in the legal papers filed in Paris, Marie, the fashion boss at the centre of the court case, described the allegations he hired a bungling killer as fanciful nonsense. Lawyers in the case, however, argued the mix-up may have been due to the similarities in appearance of the two journalists, their occupation, and the fact that they both lived in the same area of London. Jill's fiancé, Alan Farthing, was also Lisa Brinksworth's doctor, which only muddies the water of the theory even further. I will include links to several articles about the Brinksworth case on our website, if you wish to read any further into that subject. I'm reluctant to go into more detail here, as it may cause confusion regarding the Jill Dando evidence we're about to speak of. Head to www.deadsoulspodcast.com/Dando. That's D-A-N-D-O. One particular area of speculation behind Jill's death was that a London Underwood figure had ordered her killed because of her work helping the police on Crime Watch. In 2014, a friend of Jill's and a colleague at the BBC claimed that the Crime Watch presenter had been on the verge of exposing a VIP paedophile ring which included stars linked to the BBC when she was killed. The staff member, who strongly wanted to maintain her anonymity, said that Jill had approached BBC chiefs about her concerns a few months before she died, and had compiled a dossier of evidence to support her investigation and allegations. The anonymous friend and colleague said, "I don't recall the names of all the stars now, only a few, but I don't want to implicate anyone specific. But Jill said at the time that they were surprisingly big names." Jill had also received death threats following a campaign she headed up to help children spot pedophiles. The BBC actually increased security at the West London studios as a direct result of these death threats. The BBC said it had seen no evidence to substantiate any claims that Jill Dando had raised concerns over a high-profile pedophile ring at the BBC or any place else. Whilst I don't want to speculate too much at this juncture, in 2023, we have the position of hindsight in that we now know of several high-profile television stars from that time period of Jill's death who have since been exposed as prolific sex offenders at the BBC. I won't list names, but I am sure many of you are aware of who these individuals are. There are two huge stars in particular who have since been exposed. Again, I will add articles to our website for further reading for our listeners who are outside of the UK and may not know of whom I reference here. Again, deadsoulspodcast.com/Dando. Over the last 20 years, Nick Ross, the co-presenter with Jill on BBC's Crime Watch programme, has stated many times that he does not believe that Jill's death was linked to the Crime Watch show in any way. Ross last laid this claim down in an April 2019 interview with Sky News. Again, link for this is on the website. But despite Ross's public theorising, one of the first theories to gain significant traction in the investigation focused on Jill's job presenting Crime Watch. Some within the Met Police speculated that Jill's very visible and high-profile role on a show that had led to countless criminals ending up behind bars made her a prominent target. In a 2017 UK television investigative documentary that aired on the ITV television network, fuel was poured all over this conspiratorial fire when an anonymous hitman who was being interviewed told investigative journalist Mark Williams-Thomas that he knew who the killer of Dando was. The anonymous man quickly became fearful, however, and soon reverted his accusation and refused to give any further name or information for fear of retaliation. The nature of the killing does shed much doubt on any hitman theory, though, according to organised crime officers within Scotland Yard. The fact the killer left a spent cartridge at the scene was a rather large red flag. Further, the assailant didn't use a silencer on his weapon. committed the crime in a very open location with limited escape routes also implied it was less professional than it first appeared. A Metropolitan Police spokesman, Craig Hines, stated in a 2000 press discussion that it would not have taken much more effort to have been waiting in Jill's house for her when she arrived and killed her inside with no witnesses, less sound, better escape options, and a lot more time to leave the scene. A public killing seems desperate or rushed. He's right at the very basic level with these comments. At face value, the killing does in fact seem professional. But you only have to think carefully about the series of events to identify multiple and significant errors in the murder that no professional would make. Or would they? Now, one of the most enduring theories in the case is that of a Serbian hitman descending on Gowan Avenue to assassinate Jill following her fronting the BBC Kosovo crisis appeal for those fleeing the latest horrific episode of ethnic cleansing which was occurring in the Balkans at the time. In the months leading up to Jill's murder, NATO forces were heavily bombing Serbia as part of the Kosovo War. Just 3 days before Jill's death, British Tornado GR1 and Harrier GR7 jets heavily bombed Radio Television Serbia and killed 16 members of staff, including a prominent journalist who was hugely popular across Serbia. A man with an Eastern European accent was logged as calling the BBC Television Centre the day after Jill's death. In the phone call, he warned that the BBC News chief, executive Tony Hall, was next on the list to be killed. This call, whether a genuine Serbian combatant or not, only backed up suspicions that Jill's murder was actually a revenge killing. An eye for an eye. In 2012, Branka Purpa, the Croatian director of Belgrade's historical archives and well-known author, stated that Jill had been targeted because she had presented an appeal urging support for Kosovan Albanian refugees. Purpa, who is the widow of Slavko Kurovaja, a prominent Serbian journalist, believes there was a link between Jill's murder and her husband being shot dead outside their home in Belgrade 15 days before Jill's murder. The theory by Purpa has been questioned by the BBC World Affairs editor John Simpson. He has argued that Jill's tenuous connection to the conflict was unlikely to have singled her out in his view. Simpson has suggested his work covering the NATO bombing in Belgrade made him a much more obvious target than Jill was. But yet Jill was the equivalent in Serbia's eyes to their female journalist killed by British armed forces the week before. I don't know about you, but John Simpson's comments here does seem to be tainted ever so slightly with ego. So I'll leave them here with a pinch of salt. This theory, out of them all, is fairly loose in my opinion. I'm very conscious and aware that Branka Purpa was, in 2010, accused of historical revisionism by Slobodan Antioc, the Serbian political scientist. She is, however, in Croatia, considered to have a very strong and popular reputation for her expertise on 20th century history. That aside, and as always though, I'll leave you to decide and arrive at your own conclusions. Now, another theory on Jill's killing that I have looked into involves the participation of the IRA, or the Irish Republican Army. The theory stems from a letter which was issued in the year 2000 by a prisoner who was sentenced to life for murder. Well, Wayne Aird is a 55-year-old prisoner who was originally from Prudhoe in Northumberland. As I stated, he is currently serving a life sentence for murder. That being the murder of Timothy Pincott, his former flatmate in Cardiff, South Wales. Aird claims that he was a member of the IRA in the late 1990s. 3 months before Jill's death, a senior IRA figure told him of a plan to kill a big television star. He said he was flown to Dublin, then summoned on to Dundalk, where Jill Dando was named as the target. Wayne Aird wrote the letter from his cell at Wakefield Prison and said that he was a member of a 4-man gang who shot the television presenter on her doorstep in Fulham, South London, with a single 9mm bullet before they escaped in Land Rovers to a safe house in the capital city. Aird claimed that there was an establishment cover-up and said that the IRA was responsible for Jill's death, but no one had been brought to justice over the murder due to governmental fears that this might jeopardise the Northern Ireland peace process. Wayne Ed made the confession to his Leeds-based solicitor, Stuart Page. Page commented, quote, "It is quite possible the contents of his statement are pure make-believe. However, that is not a view that I have formed during my time with Mr. Ed." These claims were put forward to the police by Wayne Ed's solicitors, or attorneys for our American listeners, in the year 2000. They were also forwarded to the prosecution team of Barry George, a man we will come to shortly. Irrespective of the letter, the police at the time in 2000 chose not to investigate Ed's claims any further. Now, Wayne Ed lived in my hometown of Cardiff, South Wales, throughout the 1990s, and I have been able to conduct a fair amount of research into the man myself. The IRA connection aside, I know that Wayne Ed was a big issue seller in the Welsh capital for a number of years. For those unfamiliar, The Big Issue is a street newspaper or form of social enterprise wherein homeless individuals, or those at risk of homelessness, can sign up to distribute a weekly newspaper at minimal cost to them, which they can sell on at a profit to gain them some income. It's a scheme that operates in 10 countries and is seen as a significant support to homeless individuals and a way for them to get out of financial and social difficulty. So yes, Wayne Ed and his flatmate Timothy Pincott sold the Big Issue newspapers daily. Ed's flatmate, Timothy Pincott, was especially focused regarding the scheme and achieved significant success at selling the newspaper. He would spend around 12 hours each day on the streets generating sales. By 1999, Pincott had amassed a fortune of almost £60,000, or £134,000 equivalent in today's purchasing power, which was a huge amount from selling the newspaper alone. Pincott made the mistake of telling Ed about his fortune, however, and on the night of June 23, 1999, while the two men visited a local beach to share some alcohol, Ed bludgeoned Tim Pincott to death with a rock, leaving his pummeled body to be discovered 10 days later, as Ed helped himself to Pincott's fortune. Now, from poking around and making some inquiries in my local city, I was able to discover that Tim Pincott was a very well-educated man, a science graduate with a specialised field in biology, which he achieved from Cardiff University in 1983. Friends of both Pincott and Ed, who I managed to track down in Cardiff, said that Ed was prone to flights of fancy and often spun crazy and unbelievable stories. One friend of both Pincott and Ed, who wished to remain anonymous, stated that he would never believe a word that came out of Ed's mouth, and that he was definitely not in the IRA, expanding on that comment by saying, quote, "How many fucking Englishmen were in the IRA? An army whose sworn enemy was the fucking English? What a load of old bullshit. Ed was a murderer who was jealous and stole all of his best friend's money." Indeed, Ed tried to claim in court that he and Pincott were gay lovers and that Pincott had stolen the money from him in the first place. These are two comments that we know are untrue. Pincott was actually in a relationship with a lady from Nottingham, a location he was planning to relocate to. Perhaps that's why Ed acted when he did, as he knew that Pincott was leaving the area. That's just my personal speculation, however, just to be clear on that. Forensic accounting on Pincott's bank account following his death by criminal investigators revealed that Pincott's fortune was earned at a steady rate over a five-year period, thus dismissing Ed's second claim of the money being stolen from him. Wayne Ed just wanted attention, money and people to look up to him, a female resident of Lichfield Court, Cardiff, told me. Lichfield Court is a temporary housing apartment project run by Cardiff Council to support homeless people in the city. It was where both Ed and Pincott both lived, and where a number of friends of theirs still reside. Wayne Ed is no more a member of the IRA than Margaret Thatcher was, the same lady colourfully clarified before I left. As always, I leave the judgment regarding the credibility of this claim and theory up to you guys. The final theory I'm going to touch on in this twisted and confusing tale involves stalking. As you can imagine, with Jill being a celebrity and living in the limelight for so long, she had a large following and fan base. This ultimately led police to question whether a crazed fan of hers had been responsible for her death. Police quickly identified around 140 people who were considered to be obsessed with a television star. This included members of the public who had sent Jill any sexually explicit fan mail or photographs. Just prior to her death, Jill's engagement to obstetrician Dr. Alan Farthing had been made public, leading to speculation by law enforcement that a crazed fan may have been pushed over the edge by the news. Stranger things have happened at sea, right? London Metropolitan Police pursued the Lone Stalker theory, which included the statement from Jill's neighbour Richard Hughes, who said he heard a surprised cry from Jill. "Like someone greeting a friend," he said. To police, this suggested Jill may have recognised her killer. Scotland Yard discounted this theory when none of the 140 fans they identified, nor any of Jill's ex-boyfriends, were found to be in Fulham on the day of the murder. Although they did accept that whoever the killer was knew Jill's movements, and also knew that Jill would be leaving her fiancé's house that day and going back to her place, something only a handful of people would be aware of. Then a name came to the attention of police. Just a little more after the one-year anniversary of Jill's murder, law enforcement reviewed their investigation and singled out a number of prime suspects. One in particular, a known stalker and sex offender, piqued the interest of the police. The man was known by a number of aliases, them being Barry Bulsara, Paul Gadd, Steve Majors, Thomas Palmer, and his true identity, Barry George. Barry George lived less than a mile away from Jill at 2B Crookham Road, also in Fulham. I've been there. It's actually a fairly nice leafy middle-class neighbourhood. It's actually 0.4 of a mile from George's house to Jill's, a 9-minute walk according to Google, but I bet I could do it in 5. Anyway, George was a daydreamer and lived a fantasy life. He's been likened online and in the press to a, quote, Walter Mitty type figure. And this is due to his habit of impersonating famous figures, but personally I wouldn't put it quite so innocently as that. George was born at Hammersmith Hospital in West London on April 15, 1960. George was a wild, unpredictable and all-round difficult child. His parents were a former soldier, Paddy, and a care assistant, Margaret. They said they had Barry to save them from a troubled marriage. The relationship was extremely stormy, and George spent his early years hiding from domestic rows and vitriol. George found refuge from his miserable existence in a private world of make-believe, which would rapidly spiral out of control. The family lived in a small flat in Acton, West London. George, two elder sisters, and his parents. Paddy eventually walked out on Margaret, who was having an affair anyway. This only complicated George's emotions. He was already an obsessive individual, diagnosed with Asperger syndrome, several different personality disorders such as antisocial, histrionic, narcissistic and paranoid disorders. George also experienced somatization and factitious disorders in addition to attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Finally, George was also diagnosed with epilepsy and was measured to have an IQ of just 75. George was not a well person. To be clear, I do not and will never make light of mental illness. I'm a strong advocate for the importance of mental health support and the ongoing studies of the conditions. Mental health is real and a hell of a lot more common in our society than I think a lot of people, particularly non-sufferers, believe. Further, I do believe that those who are lucky enough to never experience issues of mental health commonly fail to understand the seriousness of the conditions, how mental health problems can be debilitating, and also the effects that it can have on a person's life and behaviours. Mental health support and care is extremely important. Now, as I said, Barry George was not a well man, and at the time of the Jill Dando murder, he was not receiving support or treatment for his list of requirements and illnesses. Throughout his life, Barry George took on a number of pseudonyms. This started at a young age while he was at Heathermount Boarding School. This was a state-funded school for children with emotional and behavioural problems. He ended up here after his parents split. His older sister moved to Ireland, and his other sister ended up in a state care home. While at Heathermount, he used the name Paul Gadd, which was the real name of singer Gary Glitter, whom George was a huge fan of. He also claimed to be Gary Glitter's real-life cousin, which of course wasn't true. He was a misfit loner, even at a school full of misfit loners. He was both a bully and bullied. older boys beat him regularly and called him Frog Boy due to his bulging eyes and deformed hair lip. But he in turn made other boys' lives miserable too by bullying them. One former pupil stated that George sexually assaulted him, saying, quote, "He was 3 years younger than me, but still he used to bully me. Once he cornered me when I was on my own. He put his hands down my pants and molested me. I felt violated, so I slammed a metal bin over his head and then hit him on the back with a snooker cue. He left me alone after that." After leaving school in 1976 with no qualifications or training, George managed to secure a job as a messenger boy at the BBC Television Centre in White City, London. He was let go after just 5 months of his 6 month contract, however. This is the only job that Barry George has ever had. In 1980, George attempted and failed at joining the Metropolitan Police Force. After receiving the rejection letter, George cut it up and fashioned a false police warrant card and decided to pose as a police officer, attempting to gain entry into the home of a woman in Surrey. He was eventually arrested and charged for this, as it's an offence in the UK to impersonate a police officer. At Kingston Magistrates Court in May 1980, George was convicted. He was fined £25 for the offence. He actually turned up to court kitted out in a sequined jacket and other glam rock attire and lied under oath, stating that his real name was Paul Gadd. He told press outside the court, quote, "It's been suggested I'm Gary Glitter's cousin, when in fact I'm the cousin of Jeff Lynne of ELO." Shortly after this incident, George claimed to be the winner of the British Karate Championships when he walked into the London offices of the Observer newspaper and claimed that he could karate chop through 47 slate tiles. He was dressed as a Japanese karate master and came in sporting a 2-foot-tall gold trophy. The trophy turned out to be stolen by George, and he was eventually outed as a fraud, with the Observer revealing his true identity. After his failure to join the police, George then attempted to join the Territorial Army after he had seen the Iranian embassy siege on the television. The Territorial Army is similar to the National Guard in the United States and other countries, a kind of military reserve force. He joined the 10th Battalion Parachute Regiment. They discharged George in 1981, less than a year after he joined, but not before he completed courses in assembling and firing rifles and machine guns. When questioned, George's senior regimental leader said, quote, "He wasn't paramaterial, he was just a wannabe. The system is designed to weed out people like him who think they can get in, look cool in a beret and play with guns." This didn't stop George then adapting the persona of SAS member Tom Palmer, however. He began telling people that he was one of the soldiers who ended the 1980 Iranian embassy siege. A bold claim. In June 1981, George was charged with 2 counts of indecent assault against 2 separate women. In court, he would be acquitted of indecent assault against the first woman, but convicted of indecent assault against the second woman. George was handed a 3-month sentence, suspended for a 2-year period. Now using the alias Steve Majors, a sort of portmanteau of Steve Austin and Lee Majors, the $6 million man and the actor who plays the character, George began telling people that he was a stuntman. The lie went as far as convincing Nottingham's Long Eaton Stadium, home to the Northern Stock Car Racing Track, to put on a stunt show in which he would jump 40 feet over 4 double-decker buses on roller skates. George actually believed he could do it too, and the show went ahead. The show sponsor, Alan Warriner, stated of the event, quote, "The lad had convinced me he could do it. He showed me photos supposedly of him doing stunts. I honestly believed it was him. On the day, the conditions were so bad that I begged him not to do the jump. I thought he'd die up there." In front of a full house and in heavy gale force winds, George, who observers said was white with fear and shaking, leapt the buses before he seriously injured himself by landing so badly he broke his leg in several places and dislocated his spine, all in front of a sellout crowd. Thus far, with the exception of the sexual assaults, things seem fairly humorous and harmless. But all that's about to change. On 10th of January 1983, George had been found by police in the grounds of Kensington Palace, the home of Prince Charles and Princess Diana. He was seen hiding in the bushes outside the palace, wearing a balaclava and carrying a poem he had written to Prince Charles. The police removed him from the area, but surprisingly did not take any formal action against him. Under the pseudonym of Steve Majors, George was convicted in March 1983 for the attempted rape of a woman in Acton, London. George was convicted at the Old Bailey, or the Central Criminal Court of England and Wales. Located in London, the court handles major criminal cases and also cases of national attention and notoriety. The attempted rape occurred in February 1982, and for this crime, George, as Majors, is sentenced to 33 months in prison. He would serve just 18 months of that sentence before being released in September of 1984. Following his release, George moved into the Conrad Hotel Bed and Breakfast in London's Gloucester Road. Fellow residents told investigators how he showed them his collection of guns, a handgun, an imitation Heckler & Koch machine gun, and a small silver handgun that he always kept hidden in a cardboard box. In 1988, George was questioned by police in regard to a series of rapes. He was also a suspect in the hunt for the killer of Rachel Nichol, who was stabbed to death in broad daylight on Wimbledon Common while walking with her two-year-old son in July 1992. George moved into a flat at 2B Crookham Road, Fulham, some 500 yards from Jill Dando's home on Gowan Avenue in 1989. He quickly established himself a reputation as a local oddball, dressing in army fatigues or stopping traffic wearing a fluorescent waistcoat and carrying a walkie-talkie with no one at the other end. Children teased him and hoped that he would chase them on his roller skates with a plastic handgun in hand. George hung out with teenagers in the area. Those teenagers would get their kicks by teasing him and making him perform for them like a circus animal. One of the teenagers was named Dave Dobbins, now a market trader in London. Dobbins stated, and I quote, "We thought it was odd that this man, who was twice our age, wanted to hang around with us. We used to take advantage of him and make him buy us beer and cigarettes. He told everybody he was a secret agent and a member of the SAS called Thomas Palmer. His everyday dress was SAS camouflage, SAS combat trousers, and SAS boots. He always had a forged ID on him to make you believe he was in the armed forces. He even told us he was one of the troops who stormed the Iranian embassy in 1980. George showed the teenagers pornography and would also take them to tourist locations that were frequented by Japanese tourists. He would often make attempts to chat up Japanese women, almost always getting turned down. But one Japanese tourist, Itsuka Toide, was so desperate for a British visa that she eventually agreed to marry George. On the 2nd of May 1989, George married the 35-year-old Japanese student Itsuka Toide. Toide was almost 10 years his senior and described the marriage as one of convenience so that she could stay in the United Kingdom. She also described her time with George as short-lived, violent, and terrifying. 4 months after the marriage in September 1989, Toide reported George to the authorities for sexual and physical assault. George was arrested and charged for this in October 1989, but the case was dropped and didn't reach court. Surprisingly, the marriage didn't end until April 1990, when Toide returned to Japan, where she is now a recluse due to her experience with George. George was arrested and charged with indecent assault again in April 1990 and again in January 1992, but neither case went to court and again both were dropped. George took on his fourth identity in 1992. He called himself Barry Bulsara after the real surname of Queen singer Freddie Mercury. George was determined to live the part, so he asked a plastic surgery clinic near his home to give him a facelift, lip enhancement, and nose correction to make him look more like what he called his cousin Mercury. The clinic, however, refused the request from George, sensing that he might not be a very mentally well man. This didn't stop George from getting the word Queen tattooed on his arms, greasing his hair back, Mercury style, and growing a pencil-thin mustache. George also spent a lot of time hanging around outside Mercury's former Kensington home, even though Mercury had died back in 1991. Concerned about George's behaviours and seemingly pointless loitering outside the residence of Mary Austin, Mercury's widow, the Queen fan club management called the police. There was no attempt by authorities to identify or address this repeat pattern in disturbing behaviour from George. Police investigating the murder of Jill Dando admitted that they had belief that George had bore a misplaced grudge against the BBC and especially Jill for maligning his dead hero Freddie. It was a fuse that fired the powder keg of violence, and George had barely kept it under control for more than 20 years. In the days after the death of Jill, George placed flowers outside the Star's home on Gowan Avenue and left a message of condolence. He gathered letters of sympathy from local shopkeepers and campaigned for the council to erect a memorial to mark Jill's terrible death. George was put under police surveillance initially and would eventually be arrested on the 25th of May and charged with Jill's murder on the 28th of May, 2000. Police who arrested George stated that he was living in a filthy rat's nest of a flat surrounded by bin liners which was stuffed with rubbish. George, they said, was obsessed and consumed by the idea of following single unknown women. Police discovered at George's residence evidence of George secretly tracking 419 unsuspecting victims over a 15-year period, making volume upon volume of notes about their daily routines. The Metropolitan Police also found more than 200 undeveloped camera films containing photographs of his targets, plus hundreds of handwritten notes containing his thoughts and fantasies about the individuals whom he stalked. There were also published articles and personal belongings relating to those who he stalked, two individuals in particular being female television stars Anthea Turner and Emma Freud. A year passes by and George is eventually tried at the Old Bailey in London and convicted on the 2nd of July 2001 of the murder of Jill Dando. He was sentenced to life imprisonment. Concern about George's conviction was widespread from the get-go on the basis that the case against George appeared wafer-thin. Two appeals by Barry George were unsuccessful, but after discredited forensic evidence was excluded from the prosecution's case, George's third appeal succeeded in November of 2007. The original conviction was quashed, and a second trial lasting just 8 weeks ended in Barry George's acquittal on the 1st of August 2008. George has been in prison for a total of 85 months at this point for something that authorities were now saying that was a crime he had not committed. So why was he convicted initially and why was he eventually acquitted? Well, the prosecution alleged that 48-year-old Barry George of Fulham was obsessed with celebrities and guns, and the jury in the original trial heard from a series of women who claimed to have been approached by him. Additionally, George, who we knew had epilepsy and mental disabilities, was found guilty based on a tiny speck of gunpowder residue which was found in George's coat pocket. The speck of residue used in evidence, although of the same type found on Jill's body after her death, could have come from other sources too, police later admitted. The retrial judge, Mr. Justice Griffith Williams, was told by defence attorneys that Barry George's IQ of 75 is in the lowest 5% of the population. In further memory and other tests conducted while in prison, George came within the bottom 1% of the population. The court was presented with this evidence at the third trial. The defence argued that Barry George was incapable of such a sophisticated killing, which involved detailed planning and specialist bullets. At the time of the original trial, prosecutors in the case stated that during undercover surveillance, police observed George approaching 38 women in the Fulham area and trying to make conversation with them. Members of the public had also mentioned Barry George's name to police and provided circumstantial evidence to his involvement, mainly that he lived in the area and he displayed strange behaviours. Police found a gun holster and lists of guns, military magazines and a picture of George wearing a gas mask and holding a starting pistol during a search of his premises. The prosecution said it was this sort of weapon that could have been converted to fire the fatal shot, but there was no direct evidence placing him at the scene of the murder or that the starting pistol he owned was actually converted to fire a 9mm bullet, nor was it likely to be the murder weapon. Jonathan Laidlaw, QC prosecuting, said George was a stalker obsessed with celebrity and guns who had a grudge against the BBC because they sacked him in 1977. All this and a microscopic piece of gun residue found in George's coat is all the evidence that it took to convict George and get him sentenced to life in prison. You have to ask yourself, would a man like George know how to obtain a 9mm handgun banned in the UK, or have the skills to convert a blank firing weapon? Additionally, would an individual bear a secret grudge against an employer for more than 20 years without actually voicing his grudge to anyone during that time? William Clegg, QC, defending, said the prosecution case was entirely circumstantial and there was no direct evidence that George was the killer or even anywhere near Gowan Avenue on the day of the murder. He said the prosecution could not prove without a reasonable doubt that Barry George was the murderer of Jill Dando. During the original police interviews, George said he didn't know Dando or even where she lived before her death was in the news. Quote, "I have never seen Jill Dando in the flesh or any shape or form," George said. In July of 2002, Bob Wolfenden wrote an article that featured in the Guardian newspaper. Following communication and discussion with a British military intelligence officer who had in-depth knowledge of this exact type of crime, Wolfenden wrote the following, quote, "From the outset, there appeared to be two vital clues to the kind of crime that this was, the method of killing and the ballistics evidence. As Dando was about to put her keys in her lock to open the front door of her home in Fulham, she was grabbed from behind with the assailant's right arm. The assailants held her and forced her to the ground so that her face was almost touching the tail step of the porch. Then, with his left hand, he fired a single shot at her left temple, killing her instantly. It was very close to 11:30 a.m. The bullet entered her head just above her ear, parallel to the ground, and came out the right side of her head and entered the front door, leaving a mark that was a mere 22 centimeters above the doorstep. This type of intentional, precise way of operating begs the question of why carry out such an elaborate scheme. Well, the intelligence service helps us answer that very question. As was previously mentioned, Jill's neighbour, who had heard her shouts, did not hear gunshots due to the silent nature of hard contact shots. This style also prevented a bloody spray, which would keep the assassin clean of evidence. It was also an incredibly quick way of carrying out a murder, all happening in under 30 seconds, as was speculated by police. While the whodunit aspects of Jill's cold case has yet to be identified, the pool of possible perpetrators and trail of theories can at least be understood to circle around professionals with the backgrounds, understanding and materials needed to carry out such swift and immaculate violence. End quote. Jill's jewellery and wallets were on her person, as was her mobile phone. This was not a botched robbery. There was a purpose, a plan, and a reason for Jill Dando's murder, but we are yet to see it and can only speculate still. Over a decade later, investigators and researchers into the murder of Jill Dando have no further clues, no further leads, and are still lost in the search for the truth regarding who was behind her death. Or so we are led to believe. Now I'm going to include another theory here. It's a fairly controversial one, and I'm pretty confident that it's a theory that Netflix will choose not to include in their documentary series, or won't be able to include for various reasons. There is a UK-based filmmaker who I'm going to source for much of this theory, and whilst the filmmaker has received significant backlash to some of his films, I think in this particular instance the theory that this gentleman has put forward is certainly worth talking about. The filmmaker is named as Richard D. Hall. Now, Hall has been attacked by the BBC, the Daily Mail and the Guardian, amongst other, for his opinions and theories regarding the Manchester Arena bombing of May 2017. But he does conduct significant research into the subject that he investigates, and I'm going to talk about a theory of his regarding Jill Dando's murder. By the way, I'm adding a link to Hall's website on my website so that you can take a look at his work and judge for yourself. Once again, visit deadsoulspodcast.com/Dando. Now, let's get into it. David Copeland. Copeland is known as the London Nail Bomber. He is alleged to have assembled and planted 3 nail bombs, each about a week apart, and detonating them at various locations around London in April 1999. The bombs were held inside sports bags, and they consisted of around 1,500 nails along with the explosives. The bombs killed 3 people and injured 140 others, and reached worldwide notoriety at the time. The bombs, built by Copeland, were exploded at Brixton Market, Brick Lane, and the Admiral Duncan pub in Soho, all in London. Copeland was an established neo-Nazi who was known by police and intelligence service prior to the bombings. The motive behind the bombs were racial and homophobic in nature. Copeland was sentenced to a minimum of 50 years imprisonment for his crimes. Now, I'm not here to go into the London nail bombings too much, as that's an episode on its own and a whole other crime to talk about, so I'm just going to gloss over what happened. Further reading regarding the bombings, however, can be found on my website, where I've left some links for you to take a look at. Once again, deadsoulspodcast.com/Dando. Now, the CCTV footage of Copeland planting the bombs and various other pieces of evidence were not released to the public until after the third bomb had been detonated on April the 30th, 1999. The footage and other evidence, however, had been obtained and were in possession of Metropolitan Police as early as after the first bombing on Saturday, April the 17th. We know this from a News of the World article dated Sunday, April the 18th, 1999, the day after the first bomb blast. This article confirmed that CCTV footage had been obtained and analysed by MI5 before handing it over to the police. The article further states that MI5 had also been in control of the investigation into the bomb blast, as there were concerns the bomb was the work of Serbian militants. I thank Borderlines for this information and the work of Dr. Larry O'Hara, who works to expose intelligence service misdeeds. His website link, once again, is on our Dando webpage. O'Hara also confirms that the News of the World article was written by a well-known MI5 and Met Police conduit, which raised further his interest into the matter. The purpose to release CCTV footage to the public, of course, is to use the public in helping to identify the criminal and bring him or her to justice. So why hold identity evidence back by 3 weeks, which could have helped prevent 2 further bombings? Good question. Well, firstly, Dr. Larry O'Hara, through his investigation, believes that the identity of the London nail bomber was known to MI5 on or before Monday, the 19th of April, 1999. This was through the analysing of the CCTV and photographic footage. O'Hara believes that MI5 wanted to allow Copeland to continue his mission of planting all 3 of his bombs, so did not act on their identification of the perpetrator. O'Hara believes the imminent terrorism act of 2000 was the focus of their mission. But how does this tie in with the murder of Jill Dando? As previously mentioned, Jill hosted the Crime Watch television show for the BBC. It aired monthly, and around the time of Jill's murder, it was aired on Tuesday the 20th of April, 6 days before her death. The Crime Watch studio director was a gentleman by the name of Peter Morpurgo. When interviewed by Richard Hall for his Dando research, Morpurgo confirmed the following information. That due to the first London bombing being so close to the airing of that month's episode, there was a rush in the studio to include as much information and research as they could on the bombing, which only occurred 3 days prior to production. In preparation for every episode, the details of crimes discussed in the episode are checked and authorised by police to ensure nothing is being shared that shouldn't be. On that particular episode and the rush to air the bombing information, Morpurgo stated that police okayed information that an outside agency did not agree to. This outside agency is believed to be MI5. The show went out live so that members of the public could call into the studio and provide information in real time. Now, there is a segment of the show where a witness to the bombing calls in with some information that they share with Jill Dando on live television. They confirmed to her, which she reads out on air, that they had, quote, seen people on a rooftop watching the bomb site on the day of the bombing. They were watching the bomb location from across the street on a rooftop with binoculars. This right away implies that the bomber was being monitored before even the first bomb exploded, and Hall and O'Hara are quick to assume this was by MI5. Now, on the episode, as Jill is revealing this information, she also states that someone has called in and claimed to be from the same group as the bomber. This would make them a member of Combat 18, the group that Copeland was affiliated with. Combat 18 were a far-right neo-Nazi organization with links to football riots and violence, the BNP, or British National Party, and in the United States, the Ku Klux Klan. It's visible in the episode that when Jill reveals that a caller from the same group as the bomber had called, that the senior police officer on screen with her at the time, Chief Superintendent David Hatcher, becomes visibly agitated and looks off camera for guidance. This is a key moment. The allegation or theory here is that Jill Dando had become privy to too much information regarding the MI5 mission involving David Copeland and how they were allowing to commit his bombing spree. They may have potentially been acting as agent provocateurs. Now, the BBC are a publicly funded organisation. They are paid for by the people. You can obtain most of its back catalogue with a simple request and additional payment in some scenarios. After each Crime Watch episode aired, it was followed by a mini catch-up episode that aired later that same night or later the same week. The catch-up episode updated the public on crimes featured and what evidence the public have provided in aiding the authorities in finding the criminals responsible. For some very strange reason, best known to the BBC, the Crime Watch update episode from the 20th of April 1999 is not available to the public, even though the public paid for it, and even though the studio director, Peter Morpurgo, confirmed that it does exist as he archived the episode himself on 1-inch tape. Richard Hall has attempted to request to view this tape on multiple occasions, not copy it, and not use it in a broadcast or film, but has offered to pay to view it on BBC premises at their convenience, and the BBC has blocked him each time. Simply put, was Jill Dando exposed to significant criminal information on the part of the government via MI5 that put her as a reporter and journalist in a compromised situation that the security services had to act on quickly, thus executing a professional hit, but with many seemingly amateur errors due to the speed of the operation's planning and completion? The end game being the 2000 Imminent Terrorism Act, which gave the UK government and security services, MI5 and MI6, sweeping and robust, almost unaccountable reach and freedom of operation. It's a significant conspiracy, but one that holds a hell of a lot of water. You will not hear about this from Netflix. What do you think? I will leave you all with this to think about. As previously stated, all evidence and research links will be up on our website for you to continue reading into the subject, should you so wish. Once again, head over to deadsoulspodcast.com/Dando to view at your convenience and pleasure. In all of this, let's not forget, of course, that a life has been lost. One of the good ones too, by all accounts. The lasting image of Jill Dando, no matter how callous her death may have been, will still and always be one of a kind, courageous and professional icon that was loved by millions. She was a storyteller at heart and a focused and driven journalist that let nothing get in her way of success. Jill Dando was a beacon of integrity, not just as a reporter, but as a warm, intelligent and caring human being. May we keep her memory alive. Good night.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.